Over the next several weeks, I am going to lead us on a journey through the book of Ecclesiastes, which is one of my favorite books in all the Bible. I am so excited about this series. And today, my goal is simple, and that is I hope to encourage, maybe entice you to read through the entire book of Ecclesiastes this week. It's not that long, only 12 chapters, and it is oh so inspiring. Trust me, you're really going to want to read through Ecclesiastes. If you have your printed Bibles, the best way to find Ecclesiastes is turn to the very beginning of the Bible, and there you'll find a table of contents. And then you'll find a page number, and I assume you know what to do from there. Ecclesiastes begins this way, chapter 1, verse 1. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. The first thing you need to know as you're reading through Ecclesiastes this week is that it contains the teachings, the sayings, the words of the teacher, or some translations will say the preacher, who is a sage, a teacher of wisdom in the tradition of Solomon. Now, despite what you may have been taught in Sunday school growing up, I do not think that Solomon actually wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. I'm not willing to debate or argue that with you, but as we'll see in coming weeks, Ecclesiastes is written in such a way so that it reminds us of Solomon. And as you read through Ecclesiastes, one of the things you will notice is that there are actually two different voices in the book. Most of Ecclesiastes is this long, sustained message or sermon, if you will, delivered in the first person by the teacher. But there's a second voice in the book as well. It frames or brackets the teacher's sermon. The beginning and the end, there's this third-person voice. We'll call that person the narrator. The narrator begins the book by introducing the teacher and then comes back after the teacher is done with a final summary and a word of encouragement. After introducing the teacher, that's what the narrator is doing here in verse 1, then the narrator gives us a one-sentence summary of the teacher's positive, uplifting, inspiring message. Verse 2. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Can you understand why this is one of my favorite books in the Bible? In the original language, that word there that's translated here, meaningless, literally means vapor or mist. Or breath. In the Hebrew, it's hevel. Turn it into a name and it becomes Abel. His name captures the essence of his life. It did not last long. Hevel, vapor, mist, breath. It's here and then it's gone. Try to grasp it and it disappears in your hand. Several times throughout Ecclesiastes, the teacher will say, hevel, like chasing after the wind. Metaphorically or figuratively, which is how the teacher mostly uses the word hevel, the word that's translated here, meaningless, can also be translated as absurd or vanity in some translations. I really like absurd. It's illogical. It's unreasonable. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. So the teacher's basic message, repeated throughout Ecclesiastes, is life is absurd. Doesn't make sense. It's unreasonable. It's illogical. It's an enigma. It's another good word for it. It's an enigma, this frustrating puzzle with no obvious solution. It just goes round and round and round. As you read through Ecclesiastes this weekend, by now I know you're really wanting to, you will notice that the teacher's outlook on life is mostly pessimistic. almost exclusively pessimistic. But his pessimism is hard won. He's not having a bad day. He's not having a bad week. He is reflecting on a lifetime of disappointing, frustrating experiences. Or maybe he's just responding to 18 months in isolation during a global pandemic. It could be either one. One of the reasons I'm choosing to teach through Ecclesiastes this fall is because right now the entire world is in a season in which so much of what the teacher says in Ecclesiastes resonates. As you're reading through it this week, I invite you, make a note, underline everything he says that you think, yeah, that seems kind of true right now. That resonates. He's frustrated. He's frustrated with the way life works. He's frustrated as he's getting older with the way his life is turning out. He's frustrated with God for allowing the world to operate in such a frustrating way. And we get the essence of his frustration in an opening poem in the first section of Ecclesiastes chapter 1. It begins in verse 3, and what we're about to read, think of it as like a teaser or a trailer meant to give you a preview of what's coming. This is the essence of what Ecclesiastes is about. First, there's the summary. It's all meaningless. And then verse 3. What do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. And the wind blows to the south and turns to the north, and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things, all words, he says, are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing. The ear never has its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is, and you've heard this before, there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. No one remembers the former generations. And even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. Now, doesn't that make you want to keep reading? It just pulls you along. We go back to verse 3, the fundamental problem the teacher is wrestling with, and it is a wrestling match in Ecclesiastes. Fundamental problem. The fundamental question is there any real gain or payoff or profit? It's a financial term he keeps using. Is there any real profit to humanity's activity under the sun? Is this thing really going anywhere? Are we really getting anywhere? Are we really making any progress? Is there any profit to our activity under the sun? And that phrase, under the sun, is so important. It shows up 29 times in 12 chapters. The teacher uses it as a way of describing the observable world around him. When he says, this is what life under the sun is like, he's describing his experience as a human being on planet Earth. The teacher is not speaking as a religious scholar. He does not say, the Bible says. He is not speaking as a prophet. He does not say, the Lord says. He's more of an empiricist. He's speaking from his experience. And over again, he says, this is what I see. This is what I observe happening in life under the sun. And one of his fundamental observations is that there's no real profit to human activity under the sun. Not really. Not over the long haul. For all that humanity's up to in the world, he says, we're really not making that much of a difference in the way the world fundamentally works. Generations come and go, civilizations rise and fall, but the earth, it remains and keeps on going. He uses an illustration from nature. He says that the sun hurries across the sky every day, and then at night it hurries back to its starting place and does it all over again, day after day after day, with no rest, making the sun a prime candidate for burnout. Hey, look, there are not many jokes in Ecclesiastes. And I'm going to need your help when I try one. The wind blows round and round and round it goes. It never really gets anywhere, though. Try chasing the wind. Streams flow into the sea. The sea's never full. It's wearisome. It's exhausting, the teacher says. When the teacher looks at the world, he does not see this well-ordered, good, beautiful creation. He sees, embedded in nature, an exhausting rhythm of futility. What's the point? And he sees that humanity is trapped within that cycle or that rhythm. For all we say, for all we see, for all we hear, for all we do, there's so much human activity, but not much lasting achievement. But well, what about technology? That's new. We have iPhones. I love my iPhone. It makes my world, my life, so much more convenient. I don't want to live in a world without an iPhone, without GPS. I love living in a world where my phone not only tells me where I'm going, but it announces that I have arrived. And I think the teacher would say, look, if you really are depending on your phone to tell you when you've arrived, your life really is absurd. But he's not talking about the lack of technological advancement. That's not his point. He's talking about a deeper kind of sameness. Feel it deep in your bones, don't you? Generations come and go, civilizations rise and fall. And we may work with different tools, and we may play with different toys, and we may kill each other with different weapons. But are the fundamental problems of the human condition changing that much across the ages? Do succeeding generations learn from preceding generations? Or do we keep repeating the same kind of mistakes over and over and over again? It brings to mind the image of Sisyphus from Greek mythology, pushing his boulder up the hill only to have it roll back down again, and he has to push it back up and it rolls back down over and over and over and over. It's a wearying, exhausting cycle or routine. And this is what the teacher says life under the sun is like. He's relentless with it. He doesn't stop. You read through Ecclesiastes this week and you'll see that he concludes that the pursuit of pleasure, the pursuit of success or achievement or wealth or wisdom or even righteousness, he says in the end it's all meaningless, it's all absurd. Because he says, I've observed that the righteous, they suffer. Those who try to do the right thing, they suffer, they're punished, and the wicked, they flourish. How does that make sense? He says, that's absurd. He notices, he says, that those who die are quickly forgotten by those who come along after. How many of you know the names of your grandparents? Quick show of hands. I would expect. How many of you know the names of your great-grandparents and your great-great-grandparents? We'll get a few genealogy nerds in every crowd. You see the way it works? He says it's all vapor. It's all vapor. It's absurd. It's chasing after the wind. Now, there are some bright spots in Ecclesiastes, but you have to work for them. And I'm not going to tell you where they are today. You've got to read those and find them on your own. And I expect that as you're reading through Ecclesiastes this week, there will be several moments where you will say, what about the resurrection? What about the gospel? What about Jesus Christ, his life, death, and resurrection? Doesn't the gospel nullify the teacher's observations about the absurdity of life? And of course, the gospel changes the way we read and interpret the message of Ecclesiastes. Of course it does. But what it doesn't do is give us permission to not listen to what the teacher is saying. Because he still has something to say to followers of Christ. As we'll see in the coming weeks, the more seriously we take the teacher's message about life under the sun, the more ready we are to hear the good news, and the more appreciative we are of living on the other side of the sun's resurrection. First, we must hear what the teacher has to say. Now, if we skip to the end of the book, after the teacher finishes his message or his sermon, the narrator, remember him, the third person narrator, he takes back the microphone from the teacher and puts what the teacher has just said in context, helps to shape it for the audience. This is what he says. We'll go to the very end of the book, chapter 12, verse 8. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless, just in case you didn't get the main point of the sermon. He repeats it, and then he moves on in verse 9. Not only was the teacher wise, but he also imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set out many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words in what he wrote. What you just heard from the teacher is upright and true. The words of the wise are like goads. They're collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. Be warned, then, my son, of anything in addition to them. Making many books, there's no end, and much study wearies the body. The narrator endorses the message the teacher has just shared. He endorses the teacher. He says the teacher's wise. Listen to him. He's experienced. He knows what he's talking about. He's eloquent. He's careful. He didn't make this stuff up. This is a well thought out message. His words are upright and true. Listen to what he has to say. Now, he also acknowledges that the teacher's message is uncomfortable. Likens the teacher's words to a goad, which is a spike or a nail at the end of a shepherd's staff. And the shepherd would use it to poke and to prod and to guide the sheep along the path. In other words, the message of Ecclesiastes is supposed to make us uncomfortable for our benefit. The truth will set you free. But first, it will make you miserable. Then finally, verses 13 and 14. The narrator brings the book of Ecclesiastes to a close, and this is what he says. Now that all has been heard, now that we've heard the sermon, now that all has been heard, here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of everyone. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. Teacher says everything is meaningless, it's meaningless, it's meaningless. And then the narrator comes up and says, listen to what he's saying, but also fear God and keep his commandments. Kind of reminds me of when an elder will come up after a particularly difficult or controversial sermon and thank the preacher for the message and then offer a slight amendment or a subtle correction to what's just been said, to take the sharp edges off of the sermon, to blunt the force of the message, You've heard elders do that before, right? I mean, never here, but in other churches. That's what the narrator's doing here in these last two verses. He endorses the teacher and the message. He's telling the truth. Life does not always make sense. Listen to what the teacher has to say. But then he reminds the audience, don't let anything the teacher has said be an excuse for you to disregard God and God's law. Essentially, the narrator is saying, he's right, listen to him, but fear God and keep his commandments anyway. Keep believing that God really is at work judging the world. And in this context, judgment's not negative, it's positive. Keep believing, fear God and keep his commandments, and believe that God really is making the world right, even when you can't see it. He's not wrong. The narrator says, he's not wrong. But there's more. There's more to life than what can be observed under the sun. So the narrator comes along at the end and says, trust and obey God anyway. This is not an optimistic cop-out that rejects the brutal realities of life with pie-in-the-sky platitudes. It is a deep, grounded, mature faith that honors the truth of the teacher's experience. He's not wrong. Life can seem meaningless. Your well-ordered, structured world can be turned upside down, and it can seem like chaos is raining down on you. The degrees we earn, the careers we choose, the work we do day after day after day can sometimes feel like a big old fat waste of time. Doing the right thing is sometimes punished rather than rewarded. There is tremendous injustice in the world. And it's hard at times to see it getting better. Sometimes your dream turns out to be a nightmare. Sometimes you feel like you're pushing a boulder up the hill and it rolls not just down the hill, but over you down the hill, and you have to do it over and over and over again. I wonder if that resonates with anyone here deep in your bones. I really do hope you'll read Ecclesiastes. I thought maybe about asking you to raise your hand as a sign of commitment, pledging that you'll read it. But then I thought, if nobody raises their hand, then this sermon has been meaningless. Which means the teacher's right. Which means you really should read Ecclesiastes. So let me see a show of hands. How many of you commit, pledge, I will read through Ecclesiastes this week? Let me see your hands. How many of you are telling the truth? Keep your hands up. There you go. Ecclesiastes is in the Bible for a reason. It's there for a reason. The narrator showcases the teacher's difficult message in Ecclesiastes for a reason. The teacher is saying something we need to hear, and maybe just as importantly, he's showing us something that we need to do. Because Ecclesiastes gives us permission. Gives us permission to be honest about our frustrations with life under the sun. It gives us permission to name our pain, to declare our suffering, to voice our doubts. It gives us permission to say, in the language of the King James, right now, life sucketh. To which the narrator comes in at the end and says, yes, it does. But don't give up on God. And don't give up on faith. Keep going anyway. Over the next few weeks, may God give us the courage to take seriously the teacher's difficult words. And may we have the faith to keep going, to keep trusting, to keep obeying, to keep following the risen Christ anyway.